This episode of the Partially Examined Life is brought to you by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price. Because everyone deserves a great night's sleep. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/PEL and enter promo code PEL. All right, here we are. The Partially Examined Life, episode 128, part 2 on Hillary Putnam. Last time we talked about how he's different from and similar to Saul Kripke in the previous episode and his twin Earths example. So I thought maybe we'd start out this time talking about, he puts that in terms of indexicality, which is one of those nice philosophy terms that I love. Indexicals are usually things like me and this, just anything that, you know, you understand what the word I, capital I, means. But obviously it's going to change. It's a relative term in that it's relative to the person who says it. Putnam is saying that even terms that are not obviously indexical, like this and I, have an implicit indexical element.
Well, one thing to say about indexicality, it's a classic case of intention not determining extension, because you and I have the same content to our eyes, but it's context that determines what their extension is going to be. And this is important because, in a way, that's Kripke's whole theory of reference, is that context is an important factor in what things refer to. That's the sort of the causal theory of truth.
I'm glad we're getting onto this. Yeah, there's an important affinity between words like I and this and now and tomorrow and names on Kripke's view, but then also these natural kind predicates, these common nouns.
Well, but it's interesting that, Wes, you would put it in terms of the different users of I are all using the same intention. Because that doesn't seem right to me, that what I mean by I, transparently, it's not like I just woke up from a coma and I don't know who I'm referring to, but what I mean by I, the intention of I, it's not just that it refers to me, but the actual intentional content is me, this person.
So I thought he pretty clearly said that it has the same intention, and the psychological state is just the grasping of an intention.
All right, well, indexicality and rigidity, where were you thinking?
What page is that?
I was in 146. This whole bringing up intention in the first place, since I think intention is not something that is a starring role in his final theory here, that in some ways
I'm just bringing it up because that's the way I summarized it in my notes. Did he not say it in the text? I thought he did say it in the text.
All right. It's just that threw me off for like a half hour of the first half of our discussion. So I'm trying not to repeat that here.
The thing with indexicals is they have these funny properties that normal words that aren't context sensitive in the same way don't have. And they necessitated a whole sort of like redoing of the whole framework of the theory of meaning in the late 60s and early 70s. And it became necessary to introduce a third thing different from both intention and extension, which David Kaplan calls character. So rather than just two things that you might mean by meaning, so like the name Matt perhaps has an extension, namely this guy right here, and an intention, like the concept of Matt or something. There's a third thing, this thing called character. So now we make three distinctions. We make a distinction between the character of an expression, the content of an expression, and the extension of the expression.
Where does he gets the character on what page is that?
I don't remember if he actually talks about this.
Yeah, I don't recall this language being used, but I think that works very well to rather than intention, which doesn't clarify anything.
Oh, I must have read about it in background reading. Okay.
When he alludes to indexicals, he's kind of assuming that framework, which was kind of in the process of being established. Like Kaplan was sort of shopping his view around the conference circuit at the time that this paper came out, and it was becoming sort of the standard take on indexicals.
So basically, character is just rules for determining context, right?
Yeah, so character is rules for determining content, and then maybe content is rules for determining extension.
Oh, I thought context, or I thought character was the whole context thing.
So for I, it's the character is knowing what the word I means. The content is knowing that it refers to you in particular when you're saying it.
The character of the word I is roughly the person speaking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then the content of the word I, when I, Matt, say it right now, is roughly Matt, whatever the content of Matt is. And then the extension of I is the human being sitting here right now.
So on page 151, the reason why I brought up the whole intention thing is, for these words, no one has ever suggested the traditional theory that intention determines extension. the same word I has two different extensions and two different idiolects, but it does not follow the concept that I have of myself. So now he's switching the concept and psychological state is any way different.
Wait, is this his bottom 151?
Sorry, it's 151 to 152.
Oh, I see. I got it. Okay.
Yeah. So think of a doppelganger in another world who has the same concept of himself and is using I in that exact same way, but of course is referring to someone else.
All right. So this is 152. Our theory can be summarized as saying that words like water have an unnoticed indexical component. Water is stuff that bears a certain similarity relation to water around here. Water at another time or in another place or even in another possible world has to bear the relationship same L to our water in order to be water. Thus, the theory that words have intentions, which are something like concepts associated with the words by speakers, and intention determines extension, this theory cannot be true of natural kind words like water for the same reason it cannot be true of obviously indexical words like I.
Isn't he just clarifying a particular part of the context for these natural kind words?
He's kind of giving us a different take on rigid designation, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. and part of that includes articulating the way context is factoring into rigid designation.
Exactly. So we don't pick things out with these descriptions that give us the necessary and sufficient conditions of the things. You know, we did engage in that Kripke fixing thing. So we could use descriptions or we could use ostension, but that's not because they're synonymous or the definition of the thing or something like that, or that they're by themselves of the meaning. So it's kind of like pointing. And the context is this possible world. The actual world is the context. And that's why when you vary to other possible worlds, it's still this stuff. That's the standard.
Yeah, so names and indexical expressions like I are very close. They both rigidly designate. So when I say I'm hungry right now, then the word I rigidly designates Matt in all possible worlds. The only difference between names and indexicals is that this reference fixing thing is happening anew all the time with words like I, whereas it basically just happens once with a name. But otherwise, they're very similar in the way they behave when you're talking about these hypothetical alternate circumstances, these modal situations, these counterfactuals.
Well, another way of putting this is the context is this paradigmatic case, right? So this water is the stuff that's similar or the same as this stuff right here.
Exactly.
That gets you at the sense in which it's like indexicals.
So let's see what he does with that in the next section where he brings up gold. It seems like this isn't going to give us much advance over his talk about water before 1750 when people didn't know it was H2O and comparing it with, oh, if they ran into XYZ back then, they wouldn't have been able to have any way to tell the difference. But nonetheless, the people here were referring to H2O and the people on Twin Earth were referring to XYZ. So he talks about gold, you know, that there was an operational definition of gold, you might say, 100 years ago before we understand what the atomic number and stuff. Does it have the properties that we think gold is supposed to have? And he's saying that even though back in the ancient world, maybe they didn't have a way of telling real gold from fool's gold, still what they meant by gold was still exactly what scientists now mean by gold. They just didn't have the way of picking that out.
Is it that the meaning is the same? Is that what he's saying?
He's saying the extension is the same.
Yeah.
He summarizes this at the bottom of 153. He's saying, on the view I am advocating, when Archimedes asserted that something was gold, he was not just saying that it had the superficial characteristics of gold. He was saying that it had the same general hidden structure, the same essence, so to speak, as any normal piece of local gold. Archimedes would have said that our hypothetical piece of metal X was gold, but he would have been wrong. But who's to say he would have been wrong? The answer, obviously, is we are.
Yeah, so I think that he's saying the extension is the thing that's the same. It's not the meaning that's going to be the same, because meaning is not simply extension.
That's why we can say that one was wrong and one was right.
Yeah, exactly. They had to be talking about the same stuff.
This is the point where it becomes clear to me what he means by talking about the meaning of meaning. That Putnam is starting from something like saying, well, look, we clearly understand something about what things mean. And rather than trying to start from a point of how you would derive meaning with a list of characteristics, it's not quite phenomenological what he's doing, but he's giving an account of how you would end up talking about the same thing and one of you being wrong and the other one being right. And that is like the fulcrum of where we get what we mean about meaning. Is that thing that stays the same. And in a funny way, I like that he uses this word essence here. It's almost, if you read early philosophy, you know, Aristotle and Plato, especially Aristotle, they would be talking about, well, what is it the thing that is the same when I talk about these two things that are same? And what is it by virtue of which that they're different? But particularly sameness, when we talk about one thing being the same thing as another, what is it that they are by the virtue of which they're the same? Because that ends up being their essence. And it seems to me that's almost exactly the kind of thing that Putnam's talking about. That's the part that he's preserving.
Yeah, I agree. This is another place where metaphysics is sort of getting rehabilitated, because the ancient notion of essence was a little bit not that trendy at the time. This idea, especially from 20th century logic, that, well, there's just properties. Anything that properly defines a set is a property, and either things have it or they lack it. But the idea that certain properties tell you more about the true nature of the thing than others was very much on the outs. And Putnam, in a way, is bringing at least part of that picture back here, I think. This idea that there's like brute similarity between things. Certain things are in the respects that are most relevant to them, they can be more similar to and less similar to each other. He's kind of pushing back against this. There's an article from around the same time by Nelson Goodman called Seven Strictures on Similarity, where Goodman argued that there's no such thing as two things just being similar. There's like only similarity in a respect. So this whole, you know, kind of bringing back the Aristotle picture, I think, is kind of resisting that a bit and thinking there is such a thing as, you know, similarity, period, between two different things, because certain properties are deeper properties of things than others. Certain properties are more important to the thing than others.
So as a guiding way of reading Putnam, I think of just what I've heard about him before doing this reading, which is that he's associated with pragmatism, but yet in an area like this one, he's arguing against straight up pragmatism, the interpretation of which right here is operationalism. In other words, you might say a pragmatist would say, well, if it works like gold, then for all practical purposes, it's gold. And he's saying, no, the fact that eventually, given ideal epistemic conditions, in other words, given what science could eventually figure out, if science eventually figures out that fool's gold was not in fact gold, then he wants to say, as a matter of reality, it doesn't matter if it functioned as gold in the past. Those people were wrong that claimed that this fool's gold was in fact gold. So he's taking a realist position, and he gives this kind of extended thing on 153, 154 of why someone might pursue operationalism and what's wrong with that. There's somebody who wants to pursue the operationalist thing and say, well, okay, prior to this test coming out, they really were both gold. The reason you might want to buy that as opposed to Putnam's position is because you have just some irrealist intuitions. You have some suspicion, certain skepticism about truth, and so then he wants to criticize that. So the middle of 154. The trouble is that for a strong anti-realist, truth makes no sense except as an intra-theoretic notion. The anti-realist can use truth intra-theoretically in the sense of a redundancy theory, but he does not have the notion of truth and reference available extra-theoretically. But extension is tied to the notion of truth. The extension of a term is just what the term is true of. Rather than try to retain the notion of extension via an awkward operationalism, the anti-realist should reject the notion of extension as he does the notion of truth in any extra-theoretic sense. Like Dewey, he can fall back. This is one time he mentions what we covered last episode. Like Dewey, for example, he can fall back on a notion of warranted assertability instead of truth, relativized to the scientific method if he thinks there is a fixed scientific method or to the best methods available at the time, if he agrees with Dewey that the scientific method itself evolves. All right, so can we unpack that a little bit, or do you think this is just too much of a digression from his overall point?
Well, let's say the anti-theorist can use the redundancy theory.
Anti-realist, yep.
Is that Tarski? Is that Tarski in truth? Maybe Matt can tell us.
Yeah, so the redundancy theory of truth is the sentence, Paris is the capital of France.
X is true.
Yeah. Is synonymous with the sentence, Paris is the capital of France.
Or in other words, it's true if and only if. You put in quotations, yeah, Paris is the capital of France is true if and only if, and then Paris is the capital of France without quotations. Is that?
That's not Tarski. Tarski's is just like, what makes it redundant is that it's not making an if and only if statement. It's just saying the whole meaning of truth.
You're just saying the thing over again. You don't add anything new by saying blah, blah, blah is true.
Right. But that's how it's phrased with an entailment sign. Anyway, the detail of that doesn't matter. The point is that it's a minimalist definition of truth that makes no metaphysical assumptions. You can have any metaphysical theory you want or not.
Yeah, so some people have thought that you don't have to, you know, if you just say there is no such thing as truth, like the noun. There's just like sometimes we add is true after the stuff we say, and sometimes we don't add is true after the stuff we say, but we're just saying stuff. There's no like thing, quote unquote, that is truth that we have to explain and have a theory of. There's just this verbal mannerism of saying is true every now and again.
But for an intra-theoretic notion of truth, it means that truth, this is like our William James discussion back in the day, that the meaning of truth, according to James, is that it works according to some pattern of investigation. So is it true that my glass is here in front of me? Well, if I can pick up and grab the glass, then yes, it's true. And in fact, the definition of it being true is that it is susceptible to that kind of verification. And the kind of verification is relative to what kind of investigation you're doing. That for some purposes, you would require very strict repeated examination and confirmability by experiments. For other kinds, you would have much looser.
Well, I think it's like more of a correspondence theory, right? Or am I wrong about that? It's something to do with the coherence of all the different...
Yeah, the coherence would be more like intra-theoretic. So it'd be like, you look at all the statements that we want to define as true statements. And so what is true just gets defined internally to this game of saying things are true and false. But it's not in virtue of the fact of them corresponding to something outside of this game we play.
Yes.
That they're true or false.
Which is what he's calling extra theoretic, this idea of corresponding to something mind independent. And
one thing that's really weird about this whole pragmatism in general is that it kind of became the opposite of itself. So the original version of pragmatism advocated by Charles Sanders Peirce was basically just realism. And then James, it's a little bit like less clear exactly, you know, where he stands on this. But like Peirce's version is just, I think it's the case that if you follow perfect idealized scientific inquiry to the end of time, what that converges on is going to be true. Like he was just saying that's a feature of scientific inquiry and truth, but it's not the definition of truth. Once you get into James and Dewey, they kind of make that into the definition of truth. And then
right.
Things go from being realism, which was what pragmatism originally was, depending on how exactly you spell it out. Anyway, sometimes it turns into kind of the opposite, which is a kind of relativism or anti-realism.
Right. Yeah. Or verificationism, which he thinks is really the same thing. So he brings up Carnap pretty directly here in 155.
Yeah. And Putnam is, I mean, he's realist about some things and he's anti-realist about other things. So I definitely agree with Mark here that about this kind of stuff, about what's the extension of a term, that he's a realist about. So in that sense, he's more of a classical pragmatist or a Peircean pragmatist than a Dewey-style pragmatist.
Yeah. So the anti-realist would have to reject the notion of extension, he's claiming. If you reject the notion of truth, you have to reject the notion of extension.
Yeah, 155, he says, a second motive for adopting extreme operationalist account is a dislike of unverifiable hypotheses. So that's just what I was saying there, that if you define, well, not even just defining truth, well, at first blush, it may seem as if we are saying that X is gold was false in Archimedes' time, although Archimedes could not in principle have known it was false. But this is not exactly the situation. The fact is there are a host of situations that we can describe using the very theory that tells us that X isn't gold, in which X would have behaved quite unlike the rest of the stuff Archimedes classified as gold. Okay, so if you're a pragmatist of the strong sort, then if there's no in-principle way to determine gold from fool's gold, then they're the same. And he's saying that, well, even for somebody back before we discovered the distinction between them, still, there was a difference, and so there are counterfactual situations. There are things that these people, they might not have known what experiments to do, but there still were those experiments out there. You know, if they, well, let's just try heating up as much as we can and see what it does then. Even the water and twin earth water were defined as at normal temperature and pressure, they behave the same. And if they're truly different things, then there is some physical way, whether known to the participants or not, that they can be told apart. So he's actually saying that the operationalist might want to jump to the conclusion that, gold is just the same as fool's gold if you don't have a way to tell between them. But no, strictly speaking, somebody who really cares about the behavior of things is not just their internal essence, but we call it an essence because it reveals itself in some possible behavior. Otherwise, there's no way we would distinguish the essences of things.
Yeah, he has a nice way of saying exactly that, Mark. Just above where you were reading on 155, after he mentions Carnap, he has this kind of aside. He says, "It is beyond question that scientists use terms as if the associated criteria were not necessary and sufficient conditions, but rather approximately correct characterizations of some world of theory-independent entities, and that they talk as if the later theories in a mature science were, in general, better descriptions of the same entities that earlier theories referred to. In my opinion, the hypothesis that this is right is the only hypothesis that can account for the communicability of scientific results. The closure of acceptable scientific theories under first-order logic and many other features of the scientific method. He's not going to take up trying to prove that, but as an aside, you see some of the way in which he's a classical pragmatist, the way Matt was saying.
Yeah, so you can see the connection there between the semantic internalism that we talked about and this intra-theoretic truth. If you think that I'm referring to gold, I must know what gold means. Or at least if I don't, then the experts in my community do. So he's kind of even going a little farther to say, because according to Kripke, his account was that there's a causal chain between, okay, well, the people that experience this stuff called it all gold, and so I am just acting in their tradition. So even if I know less than the people who originally named it, who were at the birthing ceremony, the fact is between the bunch of us, we have the definition of gold in our head, and so...
No, there's no definition of gold. It just means that you refer to the same thing.
Even with Kripke, you could baptize it with the completely wrong description. So everyone could be under an optical illusion, for instance, and think that gold is green. It doesn't matter if the description is right, as long as you've engaged in fixing.
Yeah, it's not that there's a continuous definition going back to the original people who baptized gold. It's just that successive generations borrowed the reference from the earlier generations, and that chain goes back to the original people who baptized this stuff here gold.
Okay, but you could still see this alternate view that he's sketching out that has many of the same semantic division of labor, a chain of referencers, but that could still have it wrong according to Kripke and Putnam because they're thinking that, okay, well, between the bunch of us, we know the meaning of this, and so we'll just define it as being gold if it matches what we've called gold in the past, right? In other words, calling this stuff gold over this time amounts to a theory, according to this new position he's critiquing. And so you could then just consult the theory to see whether it's gold or not. And he wants the actual externalist part of this is to say, it doesn't even matter what the sum total of your culture's theory about it is. There's always more that potentially could be figured out that will falsify that.
So I thought that was the same as Kripke. I didn't see the difference there.
Yeah, I think it's pretty much the same, but the big difference is that Kripke doesn't have any view about what the essence of any kind is. But Putnam has the story that, for example, you know, the essence of an organism is its DNA, the essence of gold is the atomic number, et cetera, et cetera. Kripke has the idea that these things have essences, but he doesn't say what the essence is. He just thinks that there's something or other that's the essence of these things, and that's what makes the necessary statements about those things true, their essences, but I'm not going to tell you what the essence is.
I wanted to ask a question. A lot of the examples we've been giving have involved essentially progressive revisions of concepts, or we've also mentioned the birthing of a concept. And I was wondering about the throwing away of concepts and what that means about the notion of reference here. So besides all kinds of physical theories that have existed that get revised or clarified, you know, the whole story of the atom and things like that, there are plenty of theories that end up just being judged as wrong and just abandoned. You know, the caloric theory of heat is, like, you know, a standard example. Or you might even pick other things that we now think of as that kind of crazy superstition or stupidity, like phrenology or notions of humors as being the way in which blood and another substances are transported through the body. So
phlogiston.
Yeah. Okay. So any of these things. So in those cases, those accounts were abandoned as not providing the right theoretical account of the thing that was being examined. So in one way, the examples are in line with what Putnam's talking about, that there's something that you were talking about that exists, that persists along, that was the referent. And what you end up doing is you end up throwing away that concept rather than simply refining it. And I guess I'm just wondering aloud if there's something different or clarifying going on in those cases.
Yeah, I think it's really important that it's different. Those are like, so the water, the gold, the elms, tigers, these are like the normal cases, as it were, where you did succeed in referring to something the first time around. When you first stumbled across some tigers, pointed to them and said, I wonder what this is, you were actually successfully referring to something. Things get a lot weirder when we get into the stuff like phlogiston or the jadeite and nephrite case, where let's just go back to the phlogiston case. The phlogiston case, I think I'm pointing at something, you know, that's contained in an object, this stuff, baptizing it phlogiston, and then going on to investigate it and ask questions about it. But actually what happened was I wasn't referring to anything. You know, I made the mistake of thinking I was referring to something when I pointed at an object and tried to point at the phlogiston in it. I just failed to point at anything. I didn't refer.
Isn't it more precisely that I associated an extension with phlogiston, and then in the end I found a contradiction that the thing that phlogiston by its own definition, its extensive relation was at odds with the phenomena that I was expecting it to be extensively related to.
Actually, the phenomena fix the extension, right? And then you have a theory of stuff you can't see, which turns out not to be the essence of what you picked out.
Yeah. So basically that you end up coming at it from two different ways. You have, as you just said, Wes, that the phenomena fixes the extension, but then you sort of have, to confirm your theory, you have an extrapolated extension that must be true based upon your theory, and they end up not overlapping, or they don't overlap enough, or they have a contradiction between the extension that is in the phenomena that you are looking at, and so you end up throwing away the theory ham-fistedly. The theory can't be revised in such a way as to keep it. You pick something else.
He makes a joke about phlogiston, or quotes a physicist, something Smith, joking that, oh, there is such a thing as phlogiston. It's valence electrons. And he ends up sort of rejecting that. It would be a judgment call on the part of the science of, does this concept that you have before, is it close enough to something that actually ends up existing that you want to retain the term?
Yeah, exactly.
Or that you can say that there is a causal chain between what you're referring to by that and what the original people did by that.
Yeah. So was it like actually nothing that you were pointing at, or were you pointing at something and then forming a mistaken belief about it? And in the phlogiston case, I think he would say that you failed to even point at anything. There wasn't anything there for you to have a theory about. You thought the extension of phlogiston was non-empty. You thought there was something there. In fact, it turns out the extension of phlogiston is empty.
So what's the next part in meaning of meaning here?
You want to talk about pencils?
Okay. If you want to touch on that example, it's kind of a more radical.
Just one thing I think is really interesting about his use of the pencils and example here is that he's the only one actually to look at an artifact in the context of this discussion that I can really think of. There's some more recent people who do, but usually people who write on this topic are looking at what were called natural kinds in the literature of the time. So stuff like elements found in nature and species found in nature, but not artifacts like pencils. So I think it's interesting that he doesn't say too much about what the nature of a pencil really is, except that they're not animals. That's, you know. Which I think we can all agree with. But he doesn't really say what the nature of a pencil is. But he sort of, in including that as an example here, allows that maybe pencil could be a natural kind, even though it's an artifact. Or it could be a natural kind, at least in this respect. It can share these features with natural kind terms like tiger and water.
The point of this is to show that it's not just natural kinds that are rigid designators, right? It's virtually any noun.
Yeah, it's going to be any common noun, yeah. I think, on this picture.
Well, let's just say what he does in this, what he's doing. We just have said he talks about pencils and organisms.
But saying it could be the case that pencils are really organisms.
Yeah. It's a lot like Kripke's Fool's Cats example. Yeah. What if it turned out that cats were robots? Yeah. This is sort of the reverse. What if it turned out the pencils were secret, yeah, like alien life forms or something, even though we thought they were thingies made in a factory?
Yeah. So instead of doing counterfactual on a natural kind, he's doing it on this artifact. So that's the way the reversal is important.
Yeah. And I think he just wants to make exactly the same point as Kripke. He wants to say that it's epistemically possible, as it were. That is to say, we can imagine, we can wonder whether pencils are organisms. That's a coherent thing to wonder, even as we insist that it's metaphysically necessary that pencils are not animals.
I mean, it's metaphysically necessary. If they end up being animals, it's metaphysically necessary they're animals. If they end up being organisms, if they end up being not, it's metaphysically necessary they're not.
Whatever is true of these things over here that we're pointing at right now, that's the metaphysically necessary thing.
But it's epistemically possible that they're one or the other, even though we know it's not really possible.
Yeah.
Anything is possible. That's the point.
To me, this is where that distinction between metaphysically and epistemically, metaphysically necessary, which is the part that Kripke and Putnam want to really preserve while separating it from epistemic necessity, happens. He's going at it directly, but it's sort of underlying the conundrum of meaning, right? The way I understood Putnam is characterizing the problem is that you were sort of conflating or keeping together metaphysical necessity and epistemic necessity all the time.
Yeah, like Kripke, he's going to reject this conflation of the a priori and the necessary. It's a posteriori, whether it turns out to be an organism or a or not, but it's still metaphysically necessary.
Yeah, and metaphysically necessary sounds, I don't know, really like grand or something.
Hardcore.
But it ultimately just boils down to the thing, it just boils down to the truth that everything is identical to itself. Kind of boring fact that everything is identical to itself, which I think is one of the interesting features of Kripke's bringing back of metaphysical necessity. He gives us this example. Look, water is necessarily H2O. We have metaphysical necessity again, guys. But why do we have metaphysical necessity? Well, it's just because everything is identical to itself.
Yeah. Interesting.
So this stuff can't be anything other than this stuff.
Yeah.
So it has this weird combination of being like kind of trivial, but then also kind of interesting because it's that possibility of us learning that this stuff is identical to this stuff that like makes scientific inquiry work.
Yeah. On the same page on 162, at the end of the pencil discussion, he says, when we use the word pencil, we intend to refer to whatever has the same nature as normal examples of the local pencils in the natural world. Pencil is just as indexical as water or gold. And this is the point that you made just a minute ago, Matt, that they end up being sort of generic kind of species type nouns. And then he goes on to characterize another guy, Katz. His theory about cats. Katz's theory about cats. Okay.
Gerald Katz's theory of cats.
And then, But he has another nice section on top of 163, again, clarifying why it's important that rigid designators are not descriptions, that we don't need a description theory. He says, the reason we don't use cat as synonymous with a description is surely that we know enough about cats to know that they do have a hidden structure. It is good scientific methodology to use the name to refer rigidly to the things that possess that hidden structure and not to whatever happens to satisfy some description. Of course, if we knew the hidden structure, we would frame a description in terms of it, but we don't know it at this point. In this sense, the use of natural kind words reflects an important fact about our relation to the world. We know that there are kinds of things with common hidden structure, but we don't yet have the knowledge to describe all those hidden structures.
So this actually, I think, is one moment where he really does diverge from Kripke. So let's say it turns out that blah, blah, blah feature of DNA is the essence of cats. Then on Putnam's view, you kind of actually could just boil cat down to a definite description. It would be like satisfies this definition that we discovered is really the essence of cats. Whereas on Kripke's view, it seems like you're always going to be in this deferring expertise to the future situation, at least until Kripke tells us more about what he thinks an essence is.
I mean, my only quibble about that is if you picked DNA, it might satisfy the characteristic that all cats have a particular characteristic of DNA. But if that's all you meant by essence was what is the single one thing that they all have in common? But it doesn't seem like it would satisfy the other characteristic you usually mean by essence, which is somehow it gives a complete description. Unless you assume that every feature of a cat is presented by its DNA, which that seems to be pretty easy to show that that's not true.
Yeah, I think what he's assuming about the notion of an essence here is an essence explains the features that you observe of the thing. Like if such and such feature that we haven't identified yet of cat DNA is the essence of cats, that's going to explain everything we observe about cats. Whenever we observe this feature and we ask, why does the cat have this feature? Well, this fact about the DNA, that's going to answer that question or whatever the essence turns out to be.
So I'm thinking, relating this back to the it ain't necessarily so paper, it's if we find out that cats are, in fact, not animals but robots. So it seems that on Kripke's view, we have reason to believe that cats are animals. But if we actually discovered that they were robots, then they were never animals. We would not say in this world, if we discovered that cats are in fact robots or demons or whatever, we would not say, oh, we actually discovered there are no cats. There are just these robots because cat means it's an animal. However, we would not want to say that we've discovered that some robots are animals.
Well, yeah. Yeah. That's true. That's definitely true.
That's a nice synopsis. Yeah.
Yeah. So when we designated something cat, we thought it was an animal, but really we're just saying whatever this thing is, we're assuming it's a natural kind, and that fixes the rigidly designates, and then they can turn out to be robots or anything you like.
The robot scenario is very much like the phlogiston, what actually happened with phlogiston. We pointed at these cats. We thought we were pointing at some animals, but in fact, we weren't pointing at, we were failing to point properly. And it turns out that these things were actually robots.
We successfully pointed. We successfully fixed the referent.
It sounds like you, by comparing it to phlogiston, you're saying there's too much baggage in the word cat.
Right.
We don't want to say these robot. We just use the word cat to refer from here on out to a species of robot, because cat just, even though we use the word cat to fix the referent before, but maybe we need to get rid of that word because it has a definite description attached to it, whereas the thing itself did not.
You might want to change the word if that ever happens.
Right, so this analogy of phlogiston is exploring the someone else may feel that the correct thing to say is it turns out that there are and never were any cats arm of the option. But what he actually says in this bit is that it's sort of up for negotiation, which are the two options we take.
Before we go on, let's stop for a minute and talk about our sponsors. First, we want to thank Casper, the online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the cost. Casper is revolutionizing the mattress industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passing that savings directly to the consumer. It uses latex and memory foam, obsessively engineered, to provide just the right sink and bounce. Very soft, very comfortable, and at a very fair price. You can get a Casper mattress for $500 for a twin or $950 for a king-size mattress. Compared to industry averages, that's an outstanding price point. You can buy it easily online, totally risk-free, because Casper offers free delivery and a painless return policy within a 100-day period. You have 100 days to sleep on it to make sure you like it. That's way better than just lying down on something in a showroom, which statistically has no correlation to whether or not a bed is right for you. And you can save an additional $50 as one of our audience members by going to casper.com/PEL and entering the promo code PEL. That's casper.com/PEL, promo code PEL. Terms and conditions apply. Now, we love doing this podcast, delving deeply into these topics. We love sharing knowledge, and that is exactly what the Great Courses does. Great Courses are engaging video and audio lectures taught by top professors, perfect for all of us who love to learn. Now, in addition to a lot of great philosophy stuff that we've told you about in other episodes, we've recently dipped into the Great Courses collection on Music's Great Masters, which are lecture series exploring the life and music of well-known musicians and composers like Mozart, Beethoven, Tchaikovsky, and the one that I watched this week on Brahms. They're all taught by music historian Robert Greenberg, who is super entertaining, really high energy. Frankly, I don't even think of these like courses as in something that I should just watch for my own edification to build my cultural knowledge. Yes, it does that, but really, he's just damn entertaining. And of course, in addition to giving you a lot of biography, he'll stop and a recording will play of the piece that he's talking about. And really, there is no better way to get a handle on a bunch of pieces that are just named Opus 17, Adagio, and stuff like that than hearing that, oh, this is the one that Brahms wrote when his friend was sick or when he was getting over his fiance. They're just chock full of anecdotes. Brahms was a hilarious and very weird person. And that's pretty typical of all these guys. Now, the Great Courses offers over 500 courses in many subjects, not just philosophy and music, but history, religion, and much, much more. They're available as DVDs, digital streaming, or downloads with the Great Courses apps. Now, as one of our listeners, you get a special deal for any of these four Great Masters courses for just $9.95. That's less than $10 for 6 hours of content. The special price of $9.95 is only available for a limited time, so order today by going to thegreatcourses.com/PEL. That's thegreatcourses.com/PEL. All right, finally, Wes, tell us about Zevia.
Zevia is the zero-calorie, naturally sweetened soda that's clearly different. No sugar, no calories, and no artificial sweeteners make this a cleaner, healthier soda option. Zevia is available in 15 delicious flavors like cream soda, black cherry, cola, ginger ale, and there's even a tonic water. Every flavor is zero calories. You can drink them by themselves, or they also make excellent mixers. I'm actually a big fan of Zevia, especially the root beer flavor. I started drinking it years ago when I wanted to get away from diet sodas that use artificial sweeteners. Really good, and they're not using NutraSweet or Splenda. You can find Zevia online at Amazon.com or at your local grocery or natural food store. And if you go to Zevia.com/podcast, you could win a free six-pack. That's Zevia.com/podcast.
All right, so back to Putnam. Where were we?
I was just thinking of finishing up, getting a sense of what his theory of meaning ends up being. 164, with a section on meaning, that's one important place for that. Let us now see where we are with respect to the notion of meaning. We have now seen that the extension of a term is not fixed by a concept that the individual speaker has in his head, and this is true both because extension is, in general, determined socially. So this is like the causal theory reference. There's a division of linguistic labor as much as of real labor, and because extension is, in part, determined indexically. The extension of our terms depends on the actual nature of the particular things that serve as paradigms, and this actual nature is not, in general, fully known to the speaker. So, for instance, this sort of relates back to what we were just discussing, but we could point to tigers based on their stripes and then make that a paradigm of tiger, but it doesn't mean that there can't be tigers without stripes. But that might not be the best way to put it. But so traditional semantic theory leaves out only two contributions to the determination of extension, the contribution of society, and the contribution of the real world! We saw at the outset that meaning cannot be identified with extension, yet it cannot be identified with intention either, if intention is something like an individual speaker's concept. What are we to do? And then he talks about these two different alternatives, which amount to rejecting principle one or principle two. So one route we could take is we could give up the idea that meaning determines extension. That's number two. So this is where he kind of spells out why that's counterintuitive. If we follow this route, we might say that water has the same meaning on Earth and on Twin Earth, but a different extension. While this is the correct route to take for an absolutely indexical word like I, it seems to be incorrect for words that we have been discussing. So this is what I was thinking of with Elman Beach, where he uses this. So for Elm and Beach, if they're switched on Twin Earth, then we would not say that Elm has the same meaning on Earth and Twin Earth, even if my doppelganger stereotype of Beach, or Elm as he calls it, is identical with my stereotype of Elm. Rather, we would say that Elm and my doppelganger's idiolect means Beach. For the same reason, it seems preferable to take a different route and identify meaning with an ordered pair, or possibly an ordered n-tuple of entities, one of which is the extension. So here's the really radical thing, right? And it's a way it brings it back to Mill, right? For whom the referent was the meaning. So instead of, you know, as for Russell, we use these descriptions to pick out the reference, or in other words, the meanings determine the reference. Here, reference is part of the meaning. The extension is just part of the meaning. So this is sort of the fruits, you know, Mark, you were talking about the practical part. This is like the fruits of Kripke's theory of reference in terms of getting us to a new theory of meaning.
The n-tuple theory of meaning.
That's right. So, and I think the other part of the n-tuple is the concept part, where people have to know things. You know, and he'll talk later on about linguistic competence. Speakers actually do have to know things. They have to know these stereotypes, for instance. So it's not like the psychological states of speakers in a society end up being irrelevant. So the ordered pairs will include extension, but it will also include the sort of a new, whatever corresponds to psychological state, which he's going to break down in a much more complex way. And saying psychological state concept would be misleading, because he's going to give what he calls these vectors of what it means to have acquired a word and so on and so forth.
And so here's where he's going to bring back something like the description theory of meaning, not that having a description determines what the extension is, but that to judge someone as competent linguistically, they have to have some properties in mind. You know, they have to know them about the stereotype, about the paradigm cases. The paper, Is Semantics Possible?, is almost all about that, but he kind of sums it up in this paper as well. So do you know the meaning of the word tiger? Well, if you don't know that tiger in general have stripes and are animals and blah, 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 then you would not be judged to understand that concept at all.
Yeah. So extension is part of meaning, but also, yeah, individual competence is part of it as well.
Yeah, so you're sort of bringing back the psychological part here.
Yeah.
But it's a heuristic we use to figure out whether something falls into the extension, but it's not like the definition of what counts as falling in the extension. That's the sort of distinction he wants to insist on.
Right.
Right.
And it's going to vary depending on your particular culture. So what counts you as competent to use the term elm? Well, he thinks that he's competent to use the term elm, even though he can't distinguish an elm from a beach, or, you know, he couldn't necessarily pick out an elm from a lineup. I'm not clear that means he actually knows that word.
Yeah, he might actually, because the earlier remark where he sort of makes fun of his conflating the two would suggest that maybe he thinks his competence in that regard could use a little work.
Yeah. It's just he's not expected culturally to know the.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's
exactly.
Not. Yeah.
And that's exactly the kind of thing that you could see as varying over time. He talks about an Indian tribe who make it obligatory to know the difference between an elm and a beach.
Right, right.
Somebody who did not recognize an elm would be said not to know what it is, not to know the meaning of the word.
Right.
Not to have the word.
Yeah, that's sort of relevant to his talk of what it means to have acquired the word tiger, right, at the top of page 167. Use passes muster, which means he's not going to point at snow and say, is this a tiger or something like that. His total way of being situated in the world and his linguistic community is such that the socially determined extension of the word tiger in his idiolect is the set of tigers. Clause 2 means that speakers on Twin Earth who have the same linguistic habits as we do count as having acquired the word tiger only if the extension of tiger in their idiolect is the set of tigers. So if they are XYZ tigers, then
fool's tigers.
No go. No go on that.
So would this be a good moment to bring up that it's a defeasible list? That bit I find especially interesting.
Yeah.
So this, what's the stereotype of tiger? Generally, you know, having stripes and being about yay big and like roaring in this really deep voiced way and being like the biggest cat and being fearsome and living in like West Bengal or something. Something like that is the stereotype. But it's not a list of jointly necessary and sufficient characteristics for being a tiger. It's not anything that strict. It's this sort of loosey-goosey, in general, kind of set of rules of thumb that we can generally use to...
Hashtag not all tigers.
It is precisely. Hashtag not all tigers. That is precisely the idea. It's the same move when somebody says not all men. So they're not definitions in the sense that they're not determining what it is to be a tiger, but they're also not definitions in the sense of these characteristics aren't even going to apply to all tigers. They're going to be kind of more like rules of thumb.
And we have to have acquired that stereotype to have acquired the word.
Yeah, like to be able to figure out, it's all we have if we want to figure out what a tiger is.
That doesn't mean it's the definition or the necessary and sufficient conditions or even the meaning.
Right, exactly. And he says this, so that stereotype could change over time, that if something happens, there's a cataclysmic event and all the tigers lose their stripes, they wouldn't necessarily not be tigers anymore. Yeah. It's just that the stereotype would change. Let's say that right now, one out of every 200 doesn't have stripes. That might be true. I don't know. And all the striped ones die off. So the ones that are left... I made his example sad. Okay, I shouldn't do that.
The bottom of 167, despite the fact that he seems to have brought back a sort of psychological element. So there's a psychology to this, but again, it's important not to identify the thing with the concept. So one reason for introducing this way of speaking is that the question, does he know the meaning of the word tiger, is biased in favor of the theory that acquiring a word is coming to possess a thing called its meaning. Identify this thing with a concept, and we are back at the theory that a sufficient condition for acquiring a word is associating it with the right concept, the very theory we spent all this time refuting. So henceforth, we will acquire words rather than learn their meaning. That acquisition does have a psychological component, but the point is that we're not moving backwards into equating the meaning with a psychological grasp of a state in which we grasp something.
Yeah, it's like these stereotypes, I think, are... So, you know, we're not experts, and we don't have access to the latest theories of tigers. So it's like these stereotypes, I think, are the next best thing. We're not experts. We don't have infinite time to study them in labs. Maybe we have to make on-the-fly judgments. So, like, the sort of silver medalist in the competition for available theories of tigers is this imperfect but good enough conception of what a tiger is. It's interesting, I think, that he doesn't really get into how wrong can a stereotype be and still be useful as this kind of heuristic. So like how many false beliefs about tigers could be part of this stereotype and we still get the reference right, you know, for this whole sort of premise to just work and not go haywire.
Yeah, Kripke gives more examples on that, right? Kripke is very adamant about how you can fix a reference with a completely wrong description.
Right. And presumably at some point, once we get enough craziness into the stereotype of a tiger, we're going to become really bad at identifying tigers. But this is precisely the issue you get into when you're interested in defeasible generalizations, is like they can be a little bit wrong, but like how wrong do they get to be and still be workable?
So I was trying to find the places in here where he gets pragmatic. So I had pointed out for folks, we didn't include it in our official list of readings, in this 1990 collection that I have called Realism of the Human Face, he actually has an essay called Is Water Necessarily H2O, which goes over some of the same ground and reflects on all these papers after the fact. And he's, I think, a little more clearly pragmatist in that, but it's in here somewhat too. So 157, 158, he's talking about lemons. What's sort of the core sense of a lemon? For example, I might say, did you see the lemon, meaning the plastic lemon? A less deviant case is this. We discover tigers on Mars. That is, they look just like tigers, but they have silicon-based chemistry instead of a carbon-based chemistry. A remarkable example of parallel evolution. Are Martian tigers tigers? That depends on the context. In the case of this theory, as is the case of any theory that is orthogonal to the way people have thought about something previously, misunderstandings are certain to arise. One which has already risen is the following. A critic has maintained that the predominant sense of, say, lemon is the one in which anything with a sufficient number of the superficial characteristics of a lemon is a lemon. The same critic has suggested that having the hidden structure, the genetic code of a lemon, is necessary to being a lemon, only when lemon is used as a term of science. Both these contentions seem to me to rest on a misunderstanding, or perhaps a pair of complementary misunderstandings. So now it seems like he's being realist here. Sorry, that's 157.
What page are you on there,
by the way? 158. Jumping to the bottom of it.
Okay.
Mistake of thinking that there's an important sense of lemon, perhaps the predominant one, in which to have the superficial characteristics of a lemon is at least sufficient for being a lemon, is more plausible if among the superficial characteristics one includes being cross-fertile with lemons. But the characteristic of being cross-fertile with lemons presupposes the notion of being a lemon. Thus, even if one condition can obtain a sufficient condition in this way, to take this as inconsistent with the characterization offered here is question begging. I thought this is where he was getting, saying that there are different possible ways you could pick out something, and it sort of depends on your purposes. This is the pragmatic element here, and it's only coming through, I think, very superficially here. It seems that the overall thrust of this paper is still realistic. He's arguing against these people that are taking the phenomenal route.
In the middle of the paragraph that you skipped over down to the end of it, he says, at the same time, the sense in which to be a lemon, something has to have the genetic code of a lemon, is not the same as the technical sense. The technical sense, I take it, would be one in which lemon was synonymous with a description which specified the genetic code. But when we said, to change the example, that to be water, something has to be H2O, we did not mean, as we made clear, that the speaker has to know this. It is only by confusing metaphysical necessity with epistemological necessity that one can conclude that if the metaphysically necessary truth condition for being water is being H2O, then water must be synonymous with H2O, in which case is certainly a term of science. So the whole lemon discussion, I think, was enunciating the mistake that you make by confusing metaphysical and epistemological necessity. It's pragmatic insofar as he's arguing that science maintains metaphysical necessity but allows for varying epistemological, disjoins them. I shouldn't say he's arguing that. He says that's an implication. That's his view. He isn't spending the paper arguing that that's the characteristic of science. It's sort of obvious that it is.
So let's maybe compare that example to one from, I'll just read you a quote. It's from the Realism of the Human Face, is Water Necessarily H2O article, page 68 there. One of the big improvements, as he's reflecting back on this, is he was thinking at the time of the meaning of meaning, he was, along with Kripke, saying, what's important is the microstructure, right? That's what makes water H2O. But why do we care about the microstructure? Well, by this later point, Putnam is saying that the microstructure makes it obey the same scientific laws. So I was getting at this before, that what makes gold and fool's gold different is not just that they have the microstructure, but that there is some eventual way that, given the proper scientific techniques, we could figure it out. He doesn't consider situations like this, but imagine if you had just, not by any science, at any point in possible history, could you determine the difference between gold A and gold B. But yet there was still some microstructural difference such that one kind of gold has a soul in it and one kind of gold doesn't have a soul in it. But this is never going to show up with any test. It seems if you are a realist about souls, then you would have to say that we're just wrong in thinking that these are the same thing. But actually they're different. It just seems for Putnam, come on, if there's any real difference, if there's a soul, that is going to have to turn up by some eventual future science. Otherwise,
there has to be a sign of it.
Yeah.
This reminds me of the discussion we had with Chalmers, where Chalmers, in his Resurrection of Carnap, we had this exchange about there being distinctions in entities that had no sign of them, but nonetheless were actual real distinctions to be made. And he said, well, you are a verificationist, aren't you then?
Yeah.
Because I was taking the position that, well, it seems like a distinction without a difference if you can't actually find any sign of that distinction. And he wanted to say that, well, of course it's a distinction.
Well, if you're a realist, you might be prone to believe that even if
you would say it's a real distinction,
there are things that, because of our cognitive limitations, we can't ever possibly know.
Yeah.
That those things are still there and real.
That's what's always confused me. It's taken me a long time to figure out what the term realist means in philosophy, because when you say that, I understand that that's what is meant by the term realist, but it seems so counterintuitive about what you would mean by something being real.
The ultimate name of Putnam's position is called internal realism, and it's actually supposed to be different than this hardline metaphysical realism. It is, there's always a reference.
Yeah.
We've read enough of his arguments against the operationalist to know that it can't just be, according to my current scientific theory right now, are these the same thing? Like, even if you can't tell the difference between gold and fool's gold, the fact that there is a difference means you're just wrong. It's not that the person who didn't have this conceptual distinction was correct. You could say his assertion was warranted. That's actually what the language that Dewey eventually used. He didn't even use truth anymore. He said warranted assertability. So those people were warranted in saying fool's gold and gold were the same thing. That's not the position that Putnam is going to take. But still, he thinks that there is some difference between straight up equivalence, and there's some reference to a theory. And we didn't read enough to say anything about that. Let me give an example that he gives out of here, this page 68 that I was going to read. So he's just said, the criterion of substance identity is that A and B are the same substance if and only if they obey the same scientific laws. I do not claim there's no vagueness at all in this condition of adequacy. The notion of same laws is, to be sure, somewhat vague. For example, consider an ordinary sample of iron. By the standards of high school chemistry, it is chemically pure. But it consists of different isotopes. These occur in fixed proportions, the same proportions in all naturally occurring samples, by the way. Some philosophers who use isotopes as examples appear not to know this.
Yeah, and this is pretty much what I was trying to get at earlier when I was on Putnam's conception of essence. The essence is going to be whatever it is that explains all the observable facts about the thing. I think this law business is another way of saying that.
And he continued, any naturally occurring sample of iron, which is sufficiently free of impurities, will exhibit the same lawful behavior as any other. Unless we go to a quantum mechanical level of accuracy. But if we use a cyclotron or some other fancy gadget from atomic physics to prepare a sample of iron, which is monoisotopic, that sample will, if the tests are sensitive enough, behave slightly differently from a natural sample. Should we then say that a hunk of iron consisting of a single isotope and a hunk of natural iron, consisting of the various isotopes in their normal proportions, are two different substances or one? Indeed, two naturally occurring samples may have tiny variations in the proportions with which the isotopes occur, and perhaps this will result in a slight difference in their lawful behavior. Are they samples of different substances? Well, it may depend on our interests. And in parentheses, this is the sort of talk Kripke hates. But the fact that there is some component of interest relativity here, and perhaps some drawing of arbitrary lines, does not change the fact that the degree of arbitrariness is infinitesimal compared to the arbitrariness in the almost the same matter at the time of origin criterion for the identity of tables. So he's, you know, he gives us more detail. It just sounds like most of what we put forward here, he's entirely in agreement with Kripke and just adds a little more into his positive story. And I just think that if you delve deeper into implicitly what Kripke was getting at, we were saying that he's opening up room for metaphysical truth, that he can talk about necessity again, that Putnam ultimately is going to have a very different agenda. Summarizing it as he is sympathetic to pragmatism, I think works pretty damn well.
One way I think you could try to reconcile this more anti-realist sounding strain from this later piece with the meaning of meaning is maybe by trying to say that the interest relativity figures into the act of pointing at something. And
exactly.
what you're pointing at depends on your interests. But then the facts that are true about the thing you pointed at, that's not interest relative.
Yeah, this is where what I see is the sort of hybrid theory of meaning, where we started out with this idea that a psychological state determines intention, which determines extension. And now we have meaning as sort of composed of extension plus whatever has become of that psychological state in terms of competence of language users. So that hybrid portion, it seems like that means that you're anchored in the world in one way through extension and rigid designation. You're also still tied to the psyche enough that you could take into account interest relativity, for instance.
Any other thoughts about what you got out of this as distinct from Kripke and why this was worth doing something on a similar topic?
There's a little section, The Meaning of Meaning, where he gives his conclusion at the end of this paper.
Go ahead, yeah.
It's on page 190. So we may now summarize what has been said in the form of a proposal concerning how we might reconstruct the notion of meaning. And at the bottom of 190, my proposal is that the normal form description of the meaning of a word should be a finite sequence or vector whose components should certainly include the following. It might be desirable to have other types of components as well. One, the syntactic markers that apply to the word, for example, noun. Two, the semantic markers that apply to the word, for example, animal, period of time. We didn't really go over that. He talks about some of that stuff above. But three, a description of the additional features of the stereotype, if any. And then four, a description of the extension. So you get in the example of water, syntactic markers are mass noun, concrete, semantic markers are natural kind, liquid. Stereotypes are colorless, transparent, tasteless, and then the extension you give by using the term H2O. He kind of goes on to say that we're not just saying that the meaning includes...
That is H2O, yeah.
Some sort of description of the extension. The meaning actually includes the extension. So again, going back to this sort of reincorporation of the million concept of meaning as just the referent, except it's referent plus. So
it's like he should join the Million Man March. Sorry.
Ooh, that was pretty
absolutely
slick.
Terrible.
Even notes at the end of the paragraph there, the objection, who are we to say what the extension of their term is in fact, has been discussed above. Note that this is fundamentally an objection to the notion of truth, and that extension is a relative of truth and inherits the family problems.
Yeah, that's going back to his argument against the operationalists.
Yeah, where he wants to preserve a notion of truth.
So it's striking, I think, that actually this proposal is not that different from what some contemporary semanticists are taking up, in particular the idea of including the stereotype as part of the meaning of a predicate. So, for example, there's a theory by Galit Sassoon. I don't know if she's published it yet, but it's a very interesting account of the phenomenon whereby when you say, is there any beer, you're not talking about is there any beer in the universe, but is there any beer here in the apartment, in the fridge? There's this interesting work by Galit Sassoon that trying to account for that context sensitivity in the meaning of the word is there, using stuff like stereotypes, using stereotypes sort of turned into schemas in cognitive science. But by having this stereotypical information associated with predicates, you can then draw on that to try to explain how the meaning of other expressions like every and any and is there shift from context to context.
How far do you think Putnam wants to take the notion of the analogy of a vector in this? Does all he mean is something that's multi-valued, you know, that has multiple components?
I think literally all he means is a tuple. It's just like an ordered, not pair, but an ordered tuple of these four things. In order to quadruple.
Because the term vector has a lot more baggage coming along with it than n-tuple, in the sense that a vector would be oriented in a basis state that you could see, you could transpose from different points of view, but there are characteristics that remain the same in it. And particularly like its length and stuff like that, that there are invariants with respect to it. Even though its individual components may change in size, the vector itself has characteristics that never change. And there's something about that image and that analogy that seems to have a lot to do with the way he's describing meaning than the notion of extension. It just seems like such a pregnant choice of term, but he doesn't go any further than that.
That's an interesting point. Yeah. Could he do all that crazy linear algebra stuff with this terminology of a vector? Could there be such a thing as a vector space? And could there be such a thing as a transformation of the space? That would be awesome if there was.
Even if there didn't end up being a algebra of it, but that he meant to include the other characteristics, like, for instance, the fact that a vector is in a space would mean that somehow that there is a space or a basis set for how you mark out meaning.
And every meaning would be a linear combination of some of the basis meaning.
Yes, and that all real meaning would have certain components of each of these components of it that all together form the space of meaning. And in some ways, that's what he's doing here, right? He's saying there's at least four dimensions of meaning. And by that, I just mean in direct analogy with spatial dimensions.
That would be so cool if he cashed any of that out, but he's definitely too lazy to do that, I think.
Let's wrap it up.
Okay.
Dylan, you want to start since you're going to...
I liked it. I found Putnam's a nice extension of Kripke. I thought that Matt's suggestion that we take these papers on as a follow-on was a great one. I found that while it was challenging, sort of intricate in his argument, I thought that it was really very readable and enjoyed it. I think I enjoyed the other two papers maybe because of their brevity. The Meaning of Meaning was definitely meatier, but maybe in that way a little more of a slog.
Well, it was nice that the last portion of it was all like responding to philosophers that we didn't read, and so we just decided to totally neglect that part.
Yeah, I agree.
Oh, it's 20 pages shorter than we thought. Awesome. For our purposes.
I also think we talked a bit about the pragmatism part, and which wasn't explicit, and Mark was trying to pull it out of here. I think it, to me, is a good example of where you can go with essentially pragmatic notions of the way science works, but maintain the basic realism. That's one of the things I liked a lot about it.
Sure. So I'll have to take this as a teaser that maybe after we do Rorty, or in the context of talking about Rorty, we can return to a little bit of Putnam's more, why he's not a straight up realist. But I think we can see that he doesn't seem to want to make the same hay about necessity and about talking about essences that we read into Kripke, that is commonly read into Kripke. So I think there is a different agenda here, and I want to read more in this tradition.
Yeah, I found them pretty pleasurable to read, like Kripke, just the sort of pleasant but very precise style, precise but affable somehow. The fundamental insight here, which is that it's not that meaning determines reference, but that meaning somehow presupposes reference, or that reference or the extension is part of meaning, is really fascinating. And of course, he's using the idea that we stipulate the referent, you know, Kripke's idea that we stipulate the referent for the purposes of counterfactuals. Well, now we stipulate the extension for the purpose of meaning. So really interesting.
Thank you, Matt.
Did Matt want to give a closing?
Sure, yeah. So this stuff of Putnam's is a little bit unusual for me personally, and that I actually agree with it. So most of the stuff that Putnam is famous for arguing, I don't find his arguments persuasive at all. When I read basically all of Putnam's other stuff, I have this simultaneous double reaction of not buying the arguments at all on the one hand, but then also really admiring his sort of breadth, the breadth of all the different influences that he draws on. I really like the way he sort of stretches to get examples from math and physics, but then also like lesser known philosophers, especially kind of at the time that he was writing. I think it was really kind of ballsy to go out and be like, hey guys, you should be reading Derrida and Heidegger too. It's not, we shouldn't just all be reading from the same small circle of authors. He really tried to draw on the widest possible range of references. And I think it definitely enriches his work. About this argument specifically, this is, as I mentioned, one of the only arguments of Putnam's that I actually buy. And perhaps it has to do with the fact that he developed this view in collaboration with Kripke. I'm not sure. One thing I think is really interesting about this whole argument from Kripke and Putnam is that there's this sort of process whereby, like in English classes and grammar school, we're taught like, well, there's this one thing, the noun, and it could be a person, place, or thing. So Matt's a noun, but dinosaur and rat are also nouns. And those are just the same kind of thing. We sort of grow up learning that. Then we take like intro logic and we're like, no. Rat and dinosaur are predicates. They're not the same. And a name, Matt is a name, and names and predicates are very different. I don't know why those English teachers taught you that nouns were all the same. So I think what happens with this Kripke-Putnam thing is that it's not that they're going back on what the logicians taught us about the difference between names and predicates, because there are important logical features of common nouns like rat and dinosaur that logic captures. But there are also maybe important analogies between names and these kinds of predicates. So maybe they're a little bit more like names than we thought. Maybe we went a little bit too kind of overboard getting so excited with the distinction between a name and a predicate. And maybe we kind of have to complicate that a little bit and recognize that some predicates are a little bit name-like in certain ways. And I think it's actually still kind of an open question in the fields exactly what we want to say about these common nouns and how exactly are they different from predicates. And there have been all kinds of like really inventive theories to try to get at that difference. But we still have yet to actually, I think, pin down the meaning of common nouns. It's an interesting sort of movement back towards the English class picture of what nouns are, where there's this unity between words like Matt and words like dinosaur. One thing I really appreciate from this whole literature is the opening up of that investigation.
All right, next time on the Partially Examined Life, we're going to talk about the rationality of religious faith. And the text we used is the final chapter of Paul Helm's 1999 Oxford Reader, Faith and Reason, which includes selections by Anthony Flew, Alvin Plantinga, Richard Swinburne, William Alston, Peter Van Inwagen, and others. Hey, we're supported by your donations. Please go to partiallyexaminedlife.com to make a contribution. Big donors since last time have included Bryce Nickel, John Givens, Francine Bunton, Moises Lopez, William Jones, Glenn Fuller, Robert Monroe, Brandon Walker, Jeffrey Hume, Stephen Norman, Stephen Linder, Peter McLean, Sean Nickerson, Guy Shokrani, Alan Hester, Brian Gifford, Axel Kvamskavang, Laura Hosford, Randall Rose, and Megan Edwards. Thanks also to the smaller donors, including those who are newly or on a continued basis signed up for our $5 a month Citizen Site. And thanks also to our audio editing group. I don't thank these people enough. We have a number of volunteers and just low-paid helpers. We divide these episodes into several pieces and farm them out. The group, some of whom are very active, some of whom only occasionally help, but they've all been extremely appreciated, includes Sean Pond, Tyler Hislop, Randall Myron, Gordon Reed, Nick Halme, Aaron Watson, John Redford, Rachel Walansky, Kyle Walton, Toby Keemer, JP Gonzalez, Jason Dorso, Chris Melrick, Martin Clem, and Nathan Reedy. So thank you. Without you guys, we could not do this. And we want to remind you, this podcast has been brought to you by Zevia, the zero-calorie, naturally sweetened soda that is clearly different. No sugar, no calories, and non-GMO Project Verified make this a cleaner, healthier soda option. Zevia is available in 15 delicious flavors like cream soda, black cherry, cola, ginger ale, and tonic water. Always zero calories, and they make excellent mixers. Go to Zevia.com/podcast, because Zevia is giving away thousands of free six-packs. Seriously, thousands have been won, and who knows, you could come home to a surprise soda on your doorstep. Random but delicious. Head to Zevia.com/podcast to get yours. That's Zevia.com/podcast. Hey, we've got a Facebook page you should go check out. You should follow us on Twitter. You should use our Amazon link to do your Amazon shopping, so we'll get a cut of that. And, of course, we accept donations, and we just love you. That's all. We just want to hang with you. All right, thanks. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Oh,
deck to take it in.